This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
Stay tuned for our bulletin of church news, which will be followed by Panorama, and then our feature, Justice and Peace. I am John Baptist Tumusime. Pope Francis has nominated Archbishop Henryk Mieczysław Jagodzinski to be the Apostolic Nuncio to South Africa and Lesotho. Before this appointment, Archbishop Jagodzinski was the Apostolic Nuncio to Ghana. In a related development, Pope Francis has nominated Archbishop Michel Skova to be the Apostolic Nuncio to the Democratic Republic of Congo. On Tuesday, Pope Francis issued a message on X, the former Twitter, inviting Catholics to pray for millions of children who live in conditions bordering on slavery. Every child who has been abandoned, marginalized, or left without health care or schooling is a cry that rises up to God, the Pope said. As you heard on this program, the Holy See announced last week that Pope Francis would be visiting the Asian country of Indonesia from September 3rd to September 6th this year. The Archbishop of Jakarta, Cardinal Ignatius Suhario, told Vatican Radio on Monday that the people of Indonesia are looking forward to the visit of the Pope. Indonesia has a population of 276 million people. 87% of these are Muslims, and Catholics are just 3.1%, that is 8.5 million. Cardinal Suhario explained that despite being a minority, Catholics live in peace with their Muslim brothers in Indonesia, and that there are quite a few families in the country whose members belong to different religions. There are also Catholic priests and religious who come from Muslim, Hindu, and Buddhist families. Meanwhile, the president of Indonesia, Joko Widodo, released a statement a few days ago saying that the visit of Pope Francis holds significant importance to the Indonesian people, not only for Catholics, but also for all religious communities. He added that the visit is expected to strengthen the message of tolerance, unity, and world peace. The Chad Catholic Bishops' Conference has appealed to the transitional government and the country's electoral commission to do everything possible to ensure that the presidential election scheduled for 6th next month is free, fair, and credible. The call was made on Monday in a statement issued by the conference in N'Djamena. In the statement, the bishops noted that the presidential election is an opportunity for the people of Chad to choose by universal suffrage the person to whom they wish to entrust the destiny of their country for the next 5 years, and this presupposes a greater responsibility to the organizers. The election is taking place when the country is experiencing serious economic, political, and security challenges. The cost of living has risen high, making it difficult for ordinary people to survive. Similarly, the government is fighting an insurgency in the north of the country, a situation that has created insecurity. 10 people, including the lead of the military government, General Mahamat Debi, the Prime Minister Success Masira, are running for the position of president. The bishops of Chad have encouraged Catholics to go and vote on election day, but to vote maturely after evaluating what the candidates stand for, and not with inclination to tribe, religion, and other superficial factors. The United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, has expressed concern about reports that the fighting factions in Sudan are arming civilians to fight in their ranks. Speaking from Geneva on Monday, Mr. Turk said that was a serious development and appealed to the leaders of the fighting factions to stop the war because it is causing death and a lot of suffering to millions of people. You can hear more on the situation in Sudan in a moment in our feature, Justice and Peace. The Food and Agriculture Organization Regional Office for Africa has warned that nearly 55 million people in West and Central Africa will find it hard to feed themselves in the dry season this year, which is predicted to start in June and end in mid-September. The situation is particularly worrying in countries such as Mali that are affected by conflict. The two regions are experiencing high inflation, which has led to a rise in the prices of goods and services, and forcing governments in Nigeria, Ghana, Sierra Leone, and Mali to devalue their currencies. According to figures provided by the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, the inflation rate in Ghana is 23%, that in Nigeria is 30%, it is 54% in Sierra Leone, 10% in Liberia, and 16% in the Gambia. The Food and Agriculture Organization is calling upon the affected countries to act now and implement policies that will accelerate the adoption and implementation of innovative programs to prevent the situation from getting out of control. You are tuned to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
World donors on Monday pledged more than $2 billion US dollars in aid to Sudan a year after a civil war erupted in the African country. The pledges were made in Paris at a summit co-hosted by France, Germany, and the European Union to raise awareness and provide desperately needed humanitarian funds for victims of the civil war. Speaking at the end of the conference, French President Emmanuel Macron said the aid will go to food, water, medicines, and other urgent needs without providing a specific timeline. Sudan descended into conflict on the 15th of April last year when simmering tensions between the National Army and the Paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, exploded into open fighting in the capital Khartoum and elsewhere across the country. Since then, thousands of people have been killed and nearly 9 million people have been forced to flee their homes, either to safer areas within Sudan or to neighboring countries. Members of Sudan's civil society took part in the Paris meeting, but neither the Sudanese army nor its rival RSF were represented. Drug regulators in Tanzania, Rwanda, and Zimbabwe have recalled a batch of children's cough syrup manufactured by Johnson & Johnson as a precautionary measure. The move came after their Nigerian counterpart said laboratory tests found high levels of toxicity in the syrup. The three countries joined Nigeria, Kenya, and South Africa in recalling the same batch of the syrup manufactured in 2021. Last week, Nigeria's Agency for Food and Drugs Administration and Control, NAFDAC, recalled a batch of the Benylin pediatric syrup after detecting the toxic substance diethylene glycol in it. The substance has been linked to the recent deaths of dozens of children in Cameroon and Gambia. Human consumption of the substance causes multiple adverse effects, including acute kidney injury, which may lead to death. Tanzania Medicines and Medical Devices Authority said it had begun the recall on the 12th of April after hearing about the Nigerian test results. A spokesperson for Kenya's drug regulator said its test results on the syrup will likely be ready on Wednesday. In Zimbabwe, the Medicines Control Agency said it did not have a record of the product's importation into Zimbabwe, but that it was concerned the syrup could enter the local market illegally. The recalled Benylin pediatric syrup, batch number 329304, was manufactured in South Africa in May 2021 and was marked with an expiry date of April 2024. Kenvue, which now owns the Benylin pediatric syrup brand, said it is collaborating with authorities and conducting its own tests. Customs authorities in Senegal have seized more than 1 ton of cocaine, the biggest inland haul of the drug ever made in the country. A lorry carrying over 1,000 kilograms of cocaine valued at $146 million was intercepted in the eastern town of Kidira, which is near the border with Mali. A BBC report said the drug had been concealed in packets and placed in bags at the bottom of the lorry, which had arrived from a neighboring country that authorities failed to name. Last November, Senegal's Navy seized 3 tons of cocaine from a ship off the country's coast, marking one of the Navy's largest drug hauls. In recent years, the region has been used as a transit point for Latin American cartels trafficking drugs to Europe and elsewhere. You're tuned to the Africa Service of Vatican Radio.
And now, our feature, Justice and Peace. For some weeks now, the East African nation of Tanzania has been experiencing one of the effects of climate change, and that is heavy rains. The rains have caused floods in low-lying areas and landslides in highlands, causing death and widespread damage. The effects of this natural disaster will be felt for some time. Father Charles Kitima is the Secretary General of the Tanzania Catholic Bishops' Conference. I got in touch with him this Tuesday in Dar es Salaam, and this is what he said about the situation.
Since the beginning of this year, several parts of Tanzania have been affected by the floods, which are caused by heavy rains. North and South Tanzania and also coastal zone are mostly affected once the people been facing these challenges, because for many years they have been building on lowland and the foundations of the houses are also not strong enough because we use the local technologies. The situation is not good in the places where floods happen, but I would like to say that the situation is well managed now. Those on the lowlands are well alerted. Those who are in the highlands, they are not alerted. In other places, you cannot predict.
Are the rains continuing in some parts of the country, or they are now coming down?
Actually, the rains are continuing. Rains are continuing. It differs from one place to another. But the main river, Rufiji River, the Bale, that is coastal area, it is very, very, very dangerous, and people are still in a difficult situation there. What we can say is that the government agencies, they have been very close to the places where there is a sign of landslide or overflowing of water.
Just tell us what the immediate effects these weather conditions have had on the people.
First of all, some people died. You know, we depend on agriculture. The farms totally destroyed in those areas. Houses destroyed. So we have thousands of people who are really lacking their crops, houses. People are going to lack subsistence, like food, income. But the government has responded with these temporary measures. We are lucky that there is a good solidarity between the government and the charitable organizations like the church and the others. We need also to bring the solidarity beyond Tanzania, because like building houses to be costly to many families, and the government may not afford to provide the houses to all affected families. Another thing which is very bad, like the one which happened in there when the school was swept away totally, which is the primary school, so children are going to lack infrastructure for their learning. Oh, another big problem now is children moving from home to schools, from home to towns. It's now a very serious problem because we don't know. The children may be moving and the water may come because of the rain somewhere far. So children are now restricted to enjoy their freedom of movement and playing and so forth.
You have mentioned the infrastructure. Are roads still existing and the communications, for example, telephones in some parts of the country, or all these have been affected?
Yeah, of course, the communication, depending on the normal infrastructure that the National Telecommunication Company of Tanzania, the infrastructure is somehow damaged in some places. But we are lucky in Tanzania. These mobile phones are well established, and we have not suffered. The communities around where we have these floods have not suffered much on that because of the mobile phones or mobile companies are really providing good services. Instant communication is intact, let's say.
This is my last question. What is the response of the local church on this situation?
The local church, normally we have to work according to the government plan, since the government issued the registration of its own. And after that, we work together with the government. But we are free to choose how to help. Like now, for us, we focus on families, focus on children, focus on investment, focus on food. We do what we can do through our national Caritas or national Caritas. We are also trying to mobilize solidarity with other public agencies beyond Tanzania.
Father Charles Kitima, the Secretary General of the Tanzania Catholic Bishops Conference, speaking from the city of Dar es Salaam. And lastly, humanitarian agencies have again expressed concern about the deteriorating situation in Sudan. Fighting between the National Army and the paramilitary rapid support forces, the RSF, has worsened the situation that was already bad. Tens of thousands of civilians have been killed, and more than 8 million others have been displaced, with some crossing into neighboring countries and others remaining scattered within the country where the conflict has not yet reached. But as the conflict continues, more people continue to be uprooted. The displaced people and many in areas where the conflict has not yet reached are experiencing shortages of food, clean water, and medicine. Schools and health facilities have been closed. Humanitarian agencies have run short of funds to cater for the displaced after donors decided to ignore their appeals. Justin Brady is the head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan. Speaking from Port Sudan, where he is based now, he explained the situation on the ground and more.
The country came in a very bad state to begin with in April 2023, dating back to October of 2021, when a coup occurred removing the civilian government. That led to basically a shutdown of any development assistance that was being given to the country. And all that was left was the humanitarian response throughout that period from October of 21 until April of last year. We saw an uptick in ethnic-based violence, as well as a major deterioration in the economy. We've seen the capital fall, a very unusual event in any conflict. Displacement from the capital has been immense. Displacement overall in the country, now somewhere over 8 million people. Almost 2 million of them have sought refuge in neighboring countries. Many of those who were displaced internally are now living with host communities in the east and the north of the country, which is slowly deteriorating the resilience of those communities, though not directly impacted by the fighting per se, but having to take on a bigger burden. We also see the infrastructure in those cities, including where I am here in Port Sudan, coming under immense strain from the rapid increase in population. Our biggest concerns are around the conflict areas in Khartoum itself, the Darfur states, which obviously have a very long history of conflict, and then the Kordofan states, as well as Jazeera State, which was a place of refuge for people from Khartoum. It's directly south of the capital, but that was taken by the RSF in December. And unfortunately, the response strategy at that time was to use large warehousing hubs, one of which was in Wad Madani, the capital of Jazeera State. We lost that. It was subsequently looted, despite assurances by the rapid support forces that it would be protected. And I'm afraid that's sort of the legacy here, is we have a lot of commitments made at a very high level, but that doesn't necessarily translate on the ground. We have recently received in the past 2 weeks, two very worrying warnings, one an alert from the famine early warning system, of a potential famine in certain areas of the country, as well as from the global IPC food security experts, which basically encourages us to act now to stop a famine.
How do you manage to continue work? Do you have an opportunity to communicate with both the government forces and the rapid support forces sides?
We are working in coordination with both sides. The access and civil military coordinations units in my office are probably my busiest. And that's intended to do both cross-line movement of supplies and experts, as well as cross-border. We've been using a cross-border entry from Chad up until recently, when the government revoked permission to use that particular crossing and have indicated a different crossing which enters into territory they control. A major impediment, and in fact, the cross-line movements have been quite limited for the past months. We've seen more impediments in terms of physical security, as well as bureaucratic impediments being imposed by the Sudanese authorities. We continue to face challenges to move about the country and to move supplies to assist people in need. We've also seen in recent months a total shutdown in the communications network within the country. Again, just about everything here is being pulled into the conflict, and this was another part of it. That prohibits Sudanese from talking to each other. Families are separated here, but also our ability to negotiate access. We had contacts all along the routes that we were using, and being able to communicate with checkpoints and with commanders in the field to inform them of movement of our supplies and personnel was essential. And that has been much, much more difficult since the telecommunication network was blacked out. We are seeing portions of it come back online, but it's a slow process. We face basically three challenges here. The number one is access. Number two are resources. We're just at about 6% of the $2.7 billion we requested for this year, and yet we're already one quarter of the way through the year. And then it's attention. Sudan is often referred to as a forgotten crisis, but I question how many knew about it to be able to forget about it.
How many people are you targeting with your aid?
Overall, we estimate about 25 million people in the country are in need of humanitarian assistance. That's almost half the population. Of those, we're trying to target 14 million, and that's probably ambitious given the context we're working in. We have almost 18 million people with acute food insecurity, with almost a million children who have severe malnutrition. So the numbers are just staggering when you look at them in abstract. What was a country with a lot of hope some years recently with the revolution and a new Sudan being born, and the result, unfortunately, is what we see today. There are human rights abuses. There are grave violations of children's rights. Sexual-based and gender-based violence is rampant and being used as a tool of war. We also have 19 million children who aren't in school. Of all the states in Sudan, only one state has its functional school system right now. We're not only seeing the sacrifice of the people of Sudan today, but potentially its future. Because if it continues in this way, and I've dealt with two famine prevention operations in my career in Somalia in 2017 and in 2022-23, both of those were successful. But I was never up against this sort of operating environment. And I don't know how we will be able to stop famine in certain areas, given the conflict dynamics, given the lack of access, and given the lack of attention by the international community on bringing it to an end.
Besides the 25 million in Sudan itself, there are many more influenced by that in the neighboring countries, especially in the situation when there are so many people who had to flee Sudan looking for some relative safety. What's the current state of affairs in the neighboring countries? What are the needs there?
You're talking about a refugee situation into countries that themselves are not the most stable. They're dealing with their own political as well as security situations, Ethiopia, South Sudan, Chad, among them. The situation of refugees, as it's reported in eastern Chad, is quite horrific. And yet people are still leaving Sudan on a daily basis to seek assistance in Chad. And I think that tells you something about how bad things are in Darfur itself. Hundreds continue to move into South Sudan, which itself has a very large humanitarian problem. So the effect that this conflict could have on the region as a whole, the Horn of Africa, but then stretching into the Sahel, is quite catastrophic. We need the international pressure to make it stop. Those who are, one, facilitating this conflict or standing by and allowing it to happen will reverse those positions and step in and try to make the two sides come to the table and end the conflict. Across the board, the needs are high. The most pressing right now, as we see it, food security, nutrition, health, and water and sanitation. As I said, our funding right now is negligible. We are starting to curtail activities. Most of the rations that people receive from the likes of WFP are cut in half already. So we can't strip more off the bone to try and make this operation work. So without more resources, not only will we not be able to stop a famine, we're not going to be able to help basically anybody. We need the international community to get off the sidelines and to engage the two parties and to bring them to the table, because this conflict is a nightmare for the Sudanese people that I don't think they ever imagined would be coming, but is now getting worse and worse.
Justin Brady, the head of the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan, speaking there to Anthony Yuspensky of UN News from Port Sudan. And that was Justice and Peace for this week. You have been listening to the English Africa Service of Vatican Radio, and I am Johnny Baptist Tumusime. In our next program at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature, Health and Healing, and our new segment on the Synod on Synodality. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus.